Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
White burial shrouds chanted death to Israel and death to America today in the Sadr City neighborhood of Baghdad. The mostly male crowd of up to 250,000 burned effigies of the Israeli Prime Minister and President Bush. On the Bush effigy was scrawled, "Saddam and Bush, two faces of one coin." It was the largest march in the entire Middle East in support of the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah since Hezbollah began fighting with Israel 3 weeks ago in southern Lebanon. In a minute, a look at financial support for Hezbollah. But first, joining us on the line from Sulaymaniyya in northern Iraq is Borzu Dargah of the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, as always, Borzu.
Thank you.
And how do you interpret this march, the turnout, for instance?
I think it's just a very, very honest reflection of a public opinion in the dominant community in Iraq, the dominant Shiite community. It's a very raw, unfiltered, uncensored expression. And it basically shows it shows the power of satellite television and the ubiquity of satellite television because, I mean, I don't know if you guys realize this over there in the States, but the version of what's happening in Lebanon that they're getting here is very different from the version that's playing on Fox TV or CNN. For example, Arabiya, which is the more moderate Arab language 24-hour news channel, its logo about this crisis, it doesn't say Middle East crisis, it doesn't say Israel versus Hezbollah, it says simply Israel attacks Lebanon. And that's the logo they have on TV, 24 hours a day as they're showing nonstop footage of what's happening. And it's creating a lot of anger in the Middle East, especially among Shiites in the Middle East. In Iraq, which has a Shiite-dominated government, there's very little censorship. There's quite a bit of freedom of expression. There's a freedom of newspapers. Mosque ceremonies are not controlled by the government. So, this is an honest expression of rage and anger.
The government approved the march in that they allowed it to happen. And you say that this non-censorship is unique pretty much in the Middle East.
Well, yeah, sure. I think and that's one of the things I'm fascinated by, the Friday prayer ceremonies in Iraq, and I always sort of want to see the highlights of the Friday prayer ceremonies on every Friday, because I think it's about the only place where they're not, censored or controlled, except for Lebanon, where I think people, the Friday prayer leaders are allowed to say what they want. I would even say it's not even a matter of the government allowing Sadr and his folks to have this march. Sadr is an integral part of the government. Muqtada Sadr, whose movement, spawned this march, is the individual in Iraq with the most seats in parliament. He controls five ministry positions, five cabinet positions, and he controls large segments of the Iraqi south as well as half of Baghdad, the Shiite section of Baghdad.
Let's remind ourselves, Muqtada al-Sadr is the anti-American cleric. The Mahdi army is under his control. The U.S. fought Muqtada al-Sadr in Najaf. Now, as you say, he's in the government. The crowd today was heard chanting, "The Mahdi army and Hezbollah are one." What is the connection?
Well, it was one of Muqtada's relatives, Musa al-Sadr, many decades ago, who went to Lebanon and helped organize the Shiite community there. These movements, these militant movements, whether the Iranian revolutionaries, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the sort of Shiite activism that's flourishing in Iraq, they're all coming from the same spring, so to speak. And it's part of a huge swelling up of Shiite political activism throughout the Middle East.
You talk about this, rising up of the Shia. How much has the situation in Lebanon shaken the already upset apple cart in Baghdad?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting because on the one hand, it's made a lot of people very angry. It's made people very angry at the U.S. troops. But also, it's kind of interesting to watch. A lot of politicians are jumping on this anti-Israel, pro-Hezbollah bandwagon because, you know, of course, it takes away attention from their own failings and get the people focused on the common enemy, and they won't focus on the fact that, for example, there's only a few hours of electricity in Baghdad still, and that, you know, the security situation is, you know, so terrible. So it's a classic political issue.
You and others have said that Israel is the one issue that unites Shia and Sunni.
Yeah, I think definitely this is a bridge issue in the lexicon of American political consultants. It's one that not only unites Sunnis and Shiites, but to some extent also the Kurds. You know, everyone is sitting there watching these images on the television. They're just looking at those images and shaking their heads and getting very angry.
Borzu Dargahi, Los Angeles Times Baghdad bureau chief, thanks as always. Well, Hezbollah. To some, as we've just heard, they are the party of God. To others, the A-team of terrorism, a disciplined army of militant Shiite Islamists raising tens of millions of dollars here in the U.S. through organized cells that run huge rackets, but also through something as simple as street sales of T-shirts in Detroit. Young Lebanese men sell the shirts to support friends and family back home in Lebanon, and many say they don't mind if some of that money filters to Hezbollah militants. Barbara Newman is co-author with Tom Diaz of Lightning Out of Lebanon, Hezbollah Terrorists on American Soil. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, thank you.
Well, it's been highly reported that Hezbollah receives upwards of $150 million from Iran, which helped found the organization. But you say Hezbollah militants receive that much money, maybe even more, from the U.S. and Latin America?
Yes, from illegal fundraising and every kind of racket you could think of. They make millions of dollars evading cigarette taxes. In other words, going from a state like North Carolina, which is a tobacco state and didn't have any taxes, and selling it illegally in Michigan and not paying taxes, they could make $2 million a truckload on cigarettes just in one shot.
There is the infamous case of a Hezbollah cell in Charlotte, North Carolina. Tell us about that cell, and does that work still exist?
That's the cell I investigated. I mean, I was really shocked because Charlotte, North Carolina, Hezbollah, part of it, you know, in tragedy there's comedy. These guys came to the University of North Carolina on Hariri fellowships. Hariri was the prime minister who was assassinated by Syria.
And we understand when you say those fellows, the leader of the cell was a Mohammed Hamoud. And in fact, he initially had difficulty getting into the U.S., but he told he told border enforcement officials that he was being prosecuted by Hezbollah.
He couldn't get a visa. We didn't have an embassy in Beirut because Hezbollah had knocked it down. So we were using the one in Syria, and they denied him two or three times. So he took a plane to a place called Margarita Island, which is located off Venezuela, where they have a lot of counterfeiters. And they counterfeited some visas for him that were so lousy he paid $300 that he was picked up on it. He knew he'd be picked up. So this is pre-911. So he told them, oh, I'm a political prisoner. I'm persecuted by Hezbollah. The customs agent knew who Hezbollah was because Hezbollah had killed more Americans than any other terrorist group before 9/11. They had killed all the Marines in 1983. And he let them go, say, okay, and you'll get a court date. They did this all the time.
So Mr. Hamoud comes to the U.S., comes to Charlotte, North Carolina, starts this cell there. This is in the 90s. They are selling these cigarettes. Tell us a little bit more about how they did this.
How they met and how they started. They all worked at Domino's Pizza, delivering pizzas. When the FBI found out about it in North Carolina, they referred it to the Justice Department, and the assistant U.S. attorney wasn't even going to prosecute. But then the Canadian intelligence came to headquarters saying, we have picked up electronically messages from some members talking to a Hezbollah procurement cell and buying high-tech equipment for them. That's why this case became important. And since then, Congress passed an act mandating that cigarette trafficking be looked at seriously because it's the main way terrorist groups in the United States fundraise.
Do you have a number of how many Hezbollah are thought to be in the U.S. raising money? I mean, when we speak of the Charlotte cell, it was six men plus the leader. So
What there were hundreds have been kicked out, you know, since the 1980s. In terms of operatives, or are you talking about, you know, so many people are just Hezbollah sympathizers. They're not active operatives.
Do we have any sense of operatives?
Yeah, I saw a figure that there are between 50 and 100 operatives between Hamas and Hezbollah in the United States.
We understand that there was a trial. Six members of the Charlotte cell, including the ringleader, Mohammed Hamoud, were prosecuted, are serving time in a federal prison. But how did they, I mean, they generated $8 million in money, we understand, from the cigarette smuggling operation.
That's only a small amount that they know. They couldn't really track it all because they sent it by courier.
I was going to say, how did they get it back to Lebanon, to Hezbollah?
Yeah. They didn't use banks. You know, I just heard about an operation going on in the war now between Hezbollah and Israel where Hezbollah has trained donkeys to carry equipment to places. They are a combination of very advanced high-tech and intelligence gathering and in weaponry and low-tech, using just, you know, money belts.
They would sometimes just hand a cashier's check or convert a cashier's check and hand it to a guy on a plane going home to Lebanon, and
that's
they would just go home.
Right. And it would be cashed in Lebanon where nobody ever asks any questions.
What other ways are Hezbollah members in America raising money for Hezbollah activities in Lebanon?
They make phony baby formula. They counterfeit Viagra. They have counterfeited Levi's jeans, which was the status symbol for men in the Middle East. They have what you call busting out credit cards. They go to the limit of one and then bust it out and get another and a new identity and so on. They have engaged in insurance fraud of claiming fires and getting money that way. Even pornography. One of the key people in this Hezbollah cell, which is supposed to be so religious, was involved in running a pornographic internet site.
Well, Barbara, we understand that there are young men who sell T-shirts on the streets of Detroit, and they know, obviously, that the money that they are getting for those T-shirts goes back to Lebanon and to Hezbollah. And they say that many of the people who buy the T-shirts know as well. Now, this becomes complicated. You lived in Lebanon, and you know that Hezbollah serves a social function as well. The group builds schools, hospitals, charities, orphanages, other infrastructure. They're an officially recognized party. Then, of course, there is their militant terrorist side. Do people in the U.S. contributing to their cause, buying T-shirts in Detroit, for instance, do you know if they think they're supporting social work or terrorism?
Well, they don't know, because Hezbollah made it very clear that whatever money it gets, it decides how it uses it. So it clearly uses it a lot for military purposes. They don't know. They can wish that it didn't go to the military side, but they can't control it.
Looking at the current situation, first of all, do you see funds being cut off to Hezbollah?
Hezbollah is very popular. And I think that there's a lot of work that the FBI is going to have to do in committing more resources to this, because I think people would take a chance, given the military situation and the pictures they see on television. I would think that they would give money to it.
We're talking to Barbara Newman, co-author of Lightning Out of Lebanon, Hezbollah Terrorists on American Soil. And by the way, she's also a former host of NPR's All Things Considered. And when we come back, more with Barbara, including what happens if Hezbollah funds in the U.S. are cut off. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Hezbollah terrorists on American soil. And Barbara, a year ago, the New York Times read an editorial in which they commended the Bush administration for the decision to go to treat Hezbollah as a political entity, saying perhaps that would demilitarize Hezbollah or make them less extreme. You said at the time, that will never happen. That's like Chamberlain going to Munich and never reading Mein Kampf. In other words, completely misreading the enemy. Do you still think it's impossible to bargain with Hezbollah politically or diplomatically?
Absolutely. You know, it's very hard for us to understand because we have always repelled revolution by letting people have a piece of the action through political parties. But we haven't had these true believers like Hezbollah. I know them. See, they may chip away this way. They decided to enter the political process in these last elections, and they got two ministers, 14 seats, and they have an alliance with their former mortal enemy, another Shiite group called Amal, and the leading Christian party run by General Michel Aoun. So they have a chokehold right now over the Lebanese parliament. They are not going to bargain away. These beliefs that they have empower them. They believe they're not acting for their own self-interest, but for the interests of their prophet. And that's what makes it so hard for Israel to deal in this war, because these are passionate, true believers. You know, they say that someone who's committed or deranged a little bit has the power and the strength of 10 people. Hezbollah does. Another thing is that, just veering a little bit into this war and strategy, Israel has relied on the same thing we have, which is intelligence satellites and computers, intel, that, and not human intelligence. So therefore, they were very successful in the Bekaa Valley because they knew they could get pictures of that structure there, but they can't get pictures of these bunkers that are all over South Lebanon. Same thing happened to us in Iraq.
But am I correct in thinking that you have also said that you believe that there was an opportunity to use diplomacy in this situation?
Absolutely. I think that they got suckered into this war.
They being Israel.
I think Israel had the high ground diplomatically. Even Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan was criticizing Hezbollah for snatching those soldiers. They have bargained with Hezbollah. They've done it in the past. A week later, they could have returned some Hezbollah prisoners.
So you're saying that diplomacy could have been used initially, but you don't think diplomacy could be used to demilitarize Hezbollah?
I absolutely think that that's right. I think that who's going to demilitarize Hezbollah? Who? And now, one of the points they talk about for a ceasefire is putting Hezbollah in the Lebanese military. The Lebanese military is already 60% Shiite. Can you imagine? So they're just going to give Hezbollah the rubric of the Lebanese army.
Barbara, there's evidence that Al-Qaeda learned many of its techniques, suicide bombing, hijacking, from Hezbollah. Do you think that Al-Qaeda may also be learning about fundraising from Hezbollah?
Al-Qaeda is not as organized as Hezbollah. Hezbollah has a fabulous centralized intelligence operation, and Al-Qaeda seems, was the center. It was never intended to be the major organization. It was the center from which like-minded groups would operate, like what happened in the tube attacks in London and the takedowns in Canada and so on. So the very intentions are different. I asked just last week one of these national security agents who gave me a briefing on background about Hezbollah. I said, what kind of a threat do they constitute to do operations in the United States? He said they'll do it if they feel hopeless. What constitutes hopeless? If the United States materially changes its relationship with Iran in a negative way. Two, if they feel like they're going to be eviscerated by this war. And three, if we cut off their ability to fundraise in the United States, the FBI thinks they could very well conduct terrorist operations here.
Barbara Newman, co-author with Tom Diaz of Lightning Out of Lebanon, Hezbollah Terrorists on American Soil. Barbara, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
A quick note now on a story of the week. Mel Gibson's spokesperson says the actor is in outpatient recovery program. You probably know Gibson has been trying to heal himself and the damage to his image after his anti-Semitic tirade during an alleged drunk driving arrest. He reportedly told the arresting officer that Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world, adding some choice expletives along with other anti-Semitic slurs. A friend quoted in today's Los Angeles Times says that's just the disease speaking, but the incident reminded Gibson critics that his father is a well-known Holocaust denier. And on a far less serious note, the story has been a gold mine for the late-night talk show hosts. Here's Steve Colbert on the Colbert Report.
During the commercial break, folks, I got some shocking news. A couple people in the audience, actually everybody in the audience, told me that Mel Gibson got arrested early Friday morning and evidently said some anti-Semitic things. I just want to say that's what alcohol does. It makes you say things you don't believe are true. Um, Listen, if I know Mel, this is just a clever marketing ploy for his new movie Apocalypto. He just bought himself some box office magic in Tehran. Anyway, Mel, if you need a lawyer, I know a good firm. Leibowitz, Silverberg, and Fishman Steinberg.
The Colbert Report. Jay Leno of The Tonight Show saw the global theme to the story.
Yeah, I don't know what Mel Gibson's next Hollywood project will be. I think we rule out Fiddler on the Roof. Yeah, I think that's out. Actually, police said today they found a bottle of tequila in Mel's Lexus. That's what they said. So let's sum up what happened here. Mel Gibson, who grew up in Australia, was drinking alcohol from Mexico in his Japanese car while yelling about the Jews in Israel. And you know where it's coming from? A Thai restaurant. So see what I'm saying? Welcome to America!
Mel Gibson has made two public apologies. He's also been calling friends to apologize to them. He doesn't seem to have suffered in the world of public opinion. A CNN poll found that more than 70% of moviegoers said they'd still show up to see him in a film. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The museum. The most common answer is Marconi, Guglielmo Marconi. The Italian engineer is credited with developing the first wireless telegraphy system in the late 1800s. But the man responsible for sending voice out over the airwaves for the first time ever is largely forgotten. Now, 100 years after Reginald Fessenden broadcast from the village of Brant Rock in Marshfield, Massachusetts, some people hope to honor his legacy. Here now, Matt Largy has the story for us.
On a little strip of land jutting into the Atlantic Ocean, the village of Brant Rock, Massachusetts, in the middle of a crowded trailer park, you can find the remnants of what some people say is the most significant step in the development of radio as we know it today.
This is the tower base where Fessenden made his broadcasts and experiments from, 1905 to roughly 1911.
That's Dave Riley, a semi-retired radio engineer who lives not too far from this spot, what used to be a huge radio tower. The base is little more than a cement block about the size of a dumpster. A weathered metal plaque reads,
"Site of first radio broadcast, December 24th, 1906, by Reginald A. Fessenden."
Reginald Aubrey Fessenden. Ring any bells? Probably not. Even in Marshfield, most people don't recognize the name or know anything about his work. But a small group of Fessenden enthusiasts is trying to preserve the memory of a man mostly overlooked in the history of radio broadcasting. Bob Demers, a ham radio operator from Marshfield, is one of them.
He is greatly overshadowed by Marconi, partly because Marconi, I believe, was much more of a self-promoter, I believe. I don't think Fessenden was into that at all. He was into so many other things. In fact, after he left Marshfield in roughly 1911, he didn't do very much in radio after that.
It only makes sense that if you can celebrate it, you ought to. And, of course, it's a good excuse to have a drink.
Ed Perry is the general manager of WATD, a commercial radio station in Marshfield. He's one of the organizers of this weekend's festivities.
You need to look at how things started, because if you don't look at how things started, you forget how to start things.
So, here's how it started. Reginald Fessenden was born in Quebec, Canada in 1866. As a boy, he was interested in a lot of big ideas, according to Dave Riley, who's been a ham radio operator, too, since he was a kid.
He must have got some genes out of the deep end of the pool also, because he was wondering about far-off stuff at a young age. His uncle Cortez was a great influence. He taught him about the telephone experiments. Well, Fessenden wondered why it couldn't be done without wires, so he set forth to do that, and naturally he did.
Fessenden dropped out of college and worked in Bermuda for a while, then went to New York to work for Thomas Edison. In 1900, he ended up at the U.S. Weather Bureau in Maryland, where he actually first sent his voice out over the airwaves, though it wasn't a broadcast, on December 23rd, 1900. This is a 1994 recreation of the 1900 transmission. Though the original wasn't hi-fi, it was still a huge leap forward. But Fessenden quit in 1902 when the Weather Bureau tried to take control of the patent rights for his inventions. So 3 years later, he moved to Brookline and started his own company, the National Electric Signaling Company, and started building the 420-foot tower at Brant Rock in Marshfield and an identical one in Macrahenish, Scotland. The goal was to show that transatlantic wireless telephony was possible, that is, communicating not just with dots and dashes, as Marconi had done, but with the voice. By the beginning of 1906, the two stations were in regular contact, though only by telegraph. Fessenden and his team worked through the summer to make transatlantic voice contact. They would test different methods by sending the signal a few miles down the coast to Plymouth, where someone was monitoring a receiver. But, as Dave Riley tells it, in November they got some unexpected news in a telegram.
It came from the undersea's cable across the Atlantic.
The message was about Fessenden's chief engineer, Adam Stein.
Fessenden called him into the office and said, can you tell me what was happening at such and such a time and what you were doing? Yeah, I was on with Plymouth and we were making adjustments. He said, well, read this. And Stein read it and he said, holy mackerel. I don't know if he said holy mackerel, but I would have.
The station in Scotland had heard Stein talking to the Plymouth team from across the ocean. Fessenden had finally done what he'd set out to do, transmit a human voice over the Atlantic. With that, Fessenden decided it was time to go public. He wanted to show the world that it was possible to transmit voices over the ether. But a few days before the big event, he got another telegram. Bob Demers picks up the story.
On December 7th, actually, he got a disastrous message from Scotland that the day before the tower had crashed.
As in, there was no way to get the signal across the ocean so that someone would actually hear it. But Fessenden decided to go ahead anyway.
Fessenden also had sold equipment to a lot of the United Fruit ships, because they were using wireless to communicate between ships. And he contacted the ships and said they wanted them to be listening on Christmas Eve at 9 o'clock for something different.
And something different is exactly what they heard. Though no recordings of that original broadcast are known to exist, we do know that Fessenden gave a short speech and then played this music, Handel's Largo, from an Edison phonograph. Dave Riley says Fessenden had asked some others to perform, but they apparently got stage fright.
So he did the whole thing himself, and it didn't last all that long. But it was copied down through the North Atlantic past Norfolk on the ships and out to sea.
He probably didn't fully understand the potential of what he'd done.
Again, Ed Perry.
It was really to show that you could talk long distances, that you could talk, remembering that virtually all the communications at that point on radio was dots and dashes. So to be able to talk, forget the fact that you could talk to a lot of people, just to be able to talk was something.
That first broadcast, and a similar one on New Year's Eve, didn't make much of an impact, especially since it wasn't even picked up across the ocean. Even Fessenden's financial backers didn't have much interest in putting voices and music on the air, and Fessenden was forced to shut down a few years later. Back in Brant Rock, Dave Riley and Bob Demers mill around in front of the tower base. The structure was torn down around 1915, but underground, spreading out in all directions, is the original copper screen that Fessenden used to ground his transmitter for those first broadcasts.
Causes one to think and reflect and have harmonic thoughts that might have been left off in those days that are still floating around here today. How does it feel when somebody goes to the Temple of Delphi? To us, this is the Radio Temple of Delphi. And it's one of the last monuments that really goes back to a true beginning.
On a nearby building, you can see a 10-foot copper rod sticking up from the roof. For the centennial year, Dave and his friends have rigged up their own transmitter at Brant Rock. Since January, they've been sending a signal out into the ether. It's the Morse code for B-O, or Bravo Ocean, very, very slowly. That's the code for Reginald Fessenden's original transmitter here, the same signal he sent out 100 years ago to announce the first voice broadcast in history and the beginning of a new era in human communication.
Our story was produced by Here and Now's Matt Largie. Out of it goes. Still to come, Life with the Brambles, the fictional family and Eliza Minot's new novel based on her own life as a mother of three and as a child. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. Ah, to many, the sound of summer, literally a lifesaver. The air conditioner. 100 years ago, Willis Carrier patented his apparatus for treating air to control humidity in factories. It's considered the precursor to modern air conditioning. And today, that century-long history has affected everything from the evolution of architecture to longer lives for the elderly. Gail Cooper is author of Air Conditioning America, Engineers and the Controlled Environment. And Gail, am I overstating the role of air conditioning?
No, I think air conditioning has really changed the way we both work and play. I think it's been very important in shaping the modern experience.
You write that the original engineers had their own ideas about what this new invention would do for us. They were looking for more of a controlled environment for everyone. Have I got that right?
Yes, most of their clients were, in fact, manufacturers, but they wanted the new technology to be man-made weather. They wanted to duplicate the best of natural climate. So they tried to think of what was the best day that they could imagine so that they could reproduce it artificially. So a sunny day at the beach, a lovely day in the mountains. Those were their models.
Sort of like the Truman Show, remember the film where he lived in this sort of controlled environment. Tick off for us some of the ways in which air conditioning has changed our lives.
Well, as you mentioned, there are two ways that it really impacts our lives. One is it helps us get away from hot summer weather, but it also helps us deal with the kinds of things that we like to do in buildings. So nobody would go to the movies in the summer because it was too hot. All those people inside a theater made it just too unbearable. And we needed air conditioning to deal with the sort of microclimates we create inside our buildings. Mm-hmm. The same was true for industrial manufacture. All that machinery inside made the atmosphere really uncomfortable.
And in some ways, it really drives the economy because you can have malls and people will go shopping and do things that when it was oppressively hot in the past, they just wouldn't do.
I think malls are sort of the new public spaces where people go power walking and relax and see some friends.
As you write, it allowed the South to be developed. But now it's also become something of a necessity. We're reading terrible stories because of the heat wave. For instance, a couple in New Jersey died in their sleep because they had closed windows against, you know, they were afraid of crime, but they didn't have an air conditioner. I mean, you know, it really has become almost a necessity.
I think in many ways it is a real lifeline in hot weather, and people are more and more concerned to make sure that everybody has access to a cool air-conditioned space. The way we build our buildings, our notions of privacy and closing the windows, they're all dependent on having mechanical ventilation and air conditioning make it possible.
But Gail Cooper, I'm wondering too if you found that, you know, the downside of air conditioning, it's completely seals people off from the rest of the world and seals us in with that air. I mean, it's a whole different way of breathing.
Well, I think the outdoors is still a big competitor to the cool air-conditioned interior. We still like to sit on the porch or do other kinds of things outside to cool down just the way we used to. But air conditioning is an important one in that whole range.
Every now and then we do stories here in the New England area of the Boston Brahmins, you know, the cut from granite, generations old people in New England who just refuse to have an air conditioner. There's something about it that seems too weak.
Well, there's a whole set of practices for keeping cool in the summer. It's the social practice of cooling. Light clothes, ice drinks, fans, time on the porch, summer vacations to someplace cooler. We had all kinds of responses to hot weather. And lots of people like those traditions, and they don't want to give them up.
Gail Cooper is a professor of history at Lehigh University and the author of Air Conditioning America, Engineers and the Controlled Environment. Gail, we understand you're up there in Maine and on a boat. Are you using air conditioning this summer?
No, I'm relying on those traditional ways of getting away from the heat. I'm out with the breezes this summer.
Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Lucky girl. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Sister Susan and Brother George are also writers. Brother Sam is a painter. Here's how Eliza writes about a typical morning in the life of a stay-at-home New Jersey mom.
The fighting for the last this, the struggle for the last that, Stephen demanding to wear the one billabong shirt that smells like sour milk, twisted wet like a cruller in the dryer that never got turned on. Sarah refusing to wear long sleeves in the winter and short sleeves in the summer, the transitions of seasons apparently really tough for her. Finally, after the most likely peak hours of nonsensical meltdowns, there's the end of the day, the finish line. The lights dim down in the swept kitchen, the dishwasher chugging along heartily, Margaret and Brian sitting in front of the TV or lying flung onto the bed. Wherever they are, the rest of the house disappears like a set on a stage where the lights are turned off.
The Brambles, Eliza Minot's new novel, is about motherhood, but it's also about three adult siblings struggling with the loss of their mother in a plane crash years ago and the impending loss of a remote father. Eliza's real mom died in a car accident nearly 30 years ago, and her Yankee dad was said to be distant. Incorporating their own family life into their literature is a trademark of the Minots, but in The Brambles, while there are echoes of her life as a child, we also feel we're hearing about the family she's now creating, and Eliza Minot joins us from her home in Maplewood, New Jersey. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, may we congratulate you because you just had another child?
Literally, I'm 2 hours home from the hospital.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, of course, people who read your books know that you and your sister Susan write about your family of origin. I want to ask you about this mom in your new novel, being that you're a new mom, but it's your fourth child. Margaret is immersed in her, as she says, abundance of children. Who is she, this woman who's, you know, she seems dazed but incredibly efficient? Is she you, or is this your way as well of fleshing out the mom that you lost?
You know, it's, I've become her. You know, when I wrote this book, I had a 2-year-old and then an infant and then finished it right before my third baby was born. And now here I am. You know, I'm living in suburban Jersey like her.
With Fruit Loops on the floor. And
I've got Fruit Loops on the floor, and I've got my Toyota Sienna. It's almost as if I had waited, I may have had better material. I'm not so sure.
Well, but, you know, when you said I've become her, I wasn't sure if you meant her, the character, or her
or my mother.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting because in your first book, The Tiny One, you write of an 8-year-old losing her mom. You were about 8, right, when your mom...
I was. Yeah. I was 7.
And now you are the mom. So I was just wondering if part of that is, you know, about trying to write what you couldn't live, you know, because she was gone so soon.
I think so. Since I was sort of on the verge of really being like the mother that I am now, I mean, mother to bigger kids, and doing it without a mother around, I sort of was preoccupied with how was it for my mother. Or, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking of her when I would write Margaret, you know, or thinking of myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I was sort of maybe projecting. I mean, I must have been, because here I am. It's like fiction has preceded real life.
You wrote yourself a primer.
That's
well,
right.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, of my sister, a mother of 4, who might say, you know, reading about the Fruit Loops on the floor and the chubby child's foot that looks like a mini éclair, or watching children's lives roll out like a tossed ball of yarn. I love that. A mother who begins to wash her hair and then forgets it.
Right.
You know, my sister might say, this isn't writing, this is taking notes.
Right.
Did you take notes?
Yes. I mean, even with toddlers, any mother knows that you're kind of all consumed.
Right.
You know, I never left shampoo in my hair, but I could imagine doing it.
You also write with pretty perfect pitch about a dying parent, dementia, decline, a daughter trying to raise her kids while her father comes home to die. Well, and of course, your dad, Harvard-educated New England banker, said to be remote.
He gets a bad rap, I must say.
Huh?
He was remote for being a guy who had 7 kids, you know.
An alcoholic as well? I mean, we know this from the reporting.
Yeah, he drank. He sort of just drank of his generation.
Yeah. Do you write of this, you know, helping a parent die from experience?
No. I did see him die, but he was, my stepmother took beautiful care of him for, 6 months mm-hmm. or longer. Mm-hmm. She was the one who did it out in California.
Does a writer get to bring their father home to die when you do it in your novel,
Yeah, in a way. Just to imagine, what it would be like to have someone like him. And at the time, it wasn't in my house, because this is not what my house was like.
Right.
But just in a house with children,
Yeah.
It would be much different if I, again, was really writing about him with kids all around him as he died. My God, that would be a... That would be quite something.
It's funny, because you and your siblings have written so much about your own family, people know, or they think they know, as I did, about your family. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's strange. You give up a certain amount of information just by writing things and leaving it up to people to imagine what's true and what's not, you know. But the percentage that I feel like I and even my siblings actually write about our life is very small compared to what really is going on. Not like it's juicier and much more dramatic, but, you write about whatever things your little mind hitches on, the overriding characteristic of someone like my mother or my father.
Right. Well, and yet, I just want to touch on something briefly. Your brother Sam mm-hmm. Told the New York Times in a recent article on All the Minots that he's a little annoyed by his siblings, reflecting family in their literature. He says his story's been hijacked by his brothers and sisters. There are a lot of, people with brothers and sisters who would not be able to write because they wouldn't, they can't imagine what a brother or sister might think.
Completely. And that's something, I've certainly never modeled a character on my brother Sam or really on anybody. I feel like the family character, if anything, I've modeled them on myself, and then maybe in the tiny one, the neighbor was a lot like my dad or,
Yeah.
A little bit this grandfather is, but if I was to really write about my father, he'd be very different than anything I've written down.
Well, you're all, bound by these family stories, even if, there's different interpretations of them. How would you characterize the bond between you and your siblings?
It's lovely. And it's really all I know in terms of, a support system and kind of the love that I kind of get from them that sort of fuels my life, really. It's not like we all sit around campfires and sing songs, but we're very close and supportive of one another.
You just get to have your little sibling annoyances displayed in the New York Times.
Which is annoying in itself, but, we got to publicize my book.
Eliza Minot, one last thought. Another character in your book, there's plot twists and turns, and we don't want to give them away. One of the characters is sense of place, and in this case, that place is suburbia. You find the beauty in the backyard that many people might find profoundly boring,
terrifying,
What are you seeing there?
I don't know whether it's from living in New York City for 10 years and then coming out here, but New Jersey it's incredibly lush and green and, fertile hubbub of life, with all these young families everywhere and little kids and flowering plants. Paradise in suburbia.
Eliza Minot, her new novel is The Brambles, a lovely summer read. Eliza, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And again, congratulations on number 4.
Thank you so much. 4 and final.
Thanks. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, maybe in the backyard, and join us again Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. An American